Welcome to Youth Speaks Out, a show by, for, and about young people. It airs on the last Sunday of each month from 2 to 3 p.m. and is hosted by young people in Mendocino County. Due to late scheduling changes, the hosts for this show were unable to be here this week, so we will listen to two archived shows. The first was the interview section from a 2001 episode entitled Racism in Our Schools. The host, Ida Levinson, interviewed Janetta McLaughlin, the only African-American teacher to work at Willits High. Janetta left after 1 year. This episode of Youth Speaks Out received a Golden Reel Award from the National Federation of Community Broadcasters in 2002.
Hi, this is Ida Levinson, and I'm from Willits. I'm a senior this year at Willits High School. I went to a small school until I was in sixth grade, and then I started going to town school when I was in seventh grade. I'm half Japanese, and my dad is Jewish, and he's from New York City. And I just want to talk about my experiences at Willits High School. Right now, I have Janetta Mutwakalem with me, and she was a teacher last year at Willits High School, and I was her teacher's assistant. She was a resource teacher, and I'm just going to ask her some questions, and she's going to tell us about her experiences and her opinions about Willits High School and racism.
I'm Janetta Mutwakalem, or Ms. Mutwakalem, as the students know me. And I grew up in the Bay Area until I was 9 years old. Then I moved up north to Willits, where I attended Bechtel Grove Middle School in the fourth grade and graduated from Bechtel Grove and went on to Willits High School and completed my senior year at Willits High School and then journeyed back down to San Francisco, to the University of San Francisco, where I majored in biology and psychology. I began teaching after I graduated from the University of San Francisco in special education and completed my credentials at San Francisco State University, where I got my regular ed, special ed, and my master's in special education. And now I'm back at the University of San Francisco for my doctorate in international multicultural education because I have strong compassion for diversity. When I first came to Willits in fourth grade, I remember my experience being kind of painful in the beginning. I was the only African-American student in my class. And so I remember, like, within the first week of school, some of the students started calling me Spiderhead because I had braids and they were, like, shooting out, you know, from my head. And, you know, I guess you could say it looked like, you know, legs of a spider, but it was still, I mean, at the time, very derogatory and very painful for me. Like, I didn't want to wear my hair in braids anymore after a while because it used to hurt my feelings for people to call me names. And then going through middle school through fifth, sixth, and seventh grade, I think especially for black women, it's really funny, but our hair is, like, important to us. Like, I went through, like, hair transitions. And by seventh grade, I noticed that the less I wore my hair in braids, the more popular I was becoming, almost to the point where by seventh grade, I was, like, a student leader. I was elected to student council, and I became a cheerleader, so I was, like, really popular among my class. Like, everyone just thought I was really cool and spirited and pretty, but it was almost like so long as my hair wasn't in braids. Like, as soon as I put my hair in braids again, it would be like wearing dreadlocks, I think, almost. Like, for it's equivalent to my friends who have been going through the process of dreading, where people think you're dirty or you're, you know, something's wrong with you when your hair is like that for so long. Like, how do you wash it? And, you know, you get all these questions that are so ignorant. Like, well, in the same way you'd wash your hair. So I used to go through that a lot. And then by high school, I was extremely active and very involved with student council, cheerleading, sports. I was really active.
So now that you've been a teacher for a year, is it any different for you than it's being a student? And what are your experiences being a teacher?
Being a teacher in Willits, wow. Well, let's just say, actually, all 7 years of my teaching experience have been pretty trying, even from my first year of teaching in Marin, where Again, I was the only African American teacher. So you really find yourself in a position of having to be a representative for your race. Working in Marin for 2 years, I found while I was in isolation, being in Marin, it was very easy for me to get to the soulful juice that I needed. Because I need to be uplifted, especially when I'm on an island. It's like being on an island by yourself and you're just trying to cope and maintain. And so I coped fine in San Rafael. Then I went to Oakland where I was surrounded by nothing but, you know, my folks, if you want to say it like that. And it was the inverse type of a struggle. There's a lot of inward racism going on there, a lot of jealousy, especially among women of color, you know, because we're all competing for the same stuff. We're all trying to do, you know, what we can to get on top, even if it means crunching the person below you, even if that person is your sister. Journeying up this way to Willits, in my first year of teaching, you know, Rod Gabrielson is the most amazing man. And, you know, he was here when I was in high school. He was one of my greatest kind of supporters in terms of me being a peer counselor at Willits High School. And when I told him I wanted to work back up here, he did everything he could to make sure I was comfortable, to make sure I had what I needed, and to make sure I felt safe. And within the first 3 weeks of my working in Willits, stuff was happening to me that I could tell wasn't the typical type of stuff that would happen to a first year teacher, that it was very much directed towards me and the color and my tone of voice and how I speak. And that's all cultural stuff. You know, how I communicate is how I've been raised to communicate. And yes, I'm a direct person. I will straight up tell you how it is. It's not about beating around the bush and being polite and not trying to crunch your toes, because if your toes need to get crunched, they're going to get crunched. And that's a hard reality for some people who have always tried to walk around anything painful. And that's what a lot of men who aren't of color can do. You know, they don't have to acknowledge stuff. If it's not happening to them, then there's no reason for them to have to go around and crunch anybody's toes, because they're not uncomfortable. And I really felt that type of vibe at Willits High School, that as much as I complained, my windows would be wide open and, you know, my screen would be missing and my fish would be stolen. Yeah. And, you know, all these things would happen to me. And I'd report it mainly to people who were close to me, because I knew that they would listen and feel my pain. But I had a really hard time going to administrators and saying, look, this is what's happening to me. What can you do about it? Because deep down, I really felt like they didn't feel the obligation to do anything about it. Take Action is the program that I started in my study skills classes, and we got about close to $5,000 in funding. And STAN has a different budget of money. And then we have a tolerance grant that we just wrote using the information that I received from students about their reaction towards racism, and then the reactions of teachers and their responses towards racism, and finding that while we have about probably 90% occurrences every day of students making racial comments or derogatory comments, then only about 47% of the teachers were able to say they actually deal with it when it happens. And that's a pretty small percentage of if you look at every time the occurrence is happening, but that's a very limited number of occurrences where students are being directly confronted for what they're saying.
I think that when you brought up the point of you being afraid to tell the school administrators, I think maybe kids feel that way too. Like they're not going to do anything about it, that they're not going to listen to them. And I think, you know, it's there. I mean, racism is happening, but how much do they hear about it? How much do the teachers hear about it? When did the principals hear about it? I mean, do the kids go to them for help? And do they think that they can get help and they're going to listen?
When I speak to a group of students, I can say the exact same thing as a person who is not a person of color could come in and say. And the students would act like they didn't understand what I just said. And it's not about the fact that my words are different. It's about who the words are coming from. And to me, that's appalling. And that's racism. That's saying that whatever you're saying is not important enough for me to listen to, number one. And number two, whatever you're saying, even if I heard it, you're not important enough for me to do it, kind of thing. And that's what I really felt the attitudes among not only the students, but several of the teachers.
What are you doing to help prevent other teachers from being treated the same way you are treated?
Well, I think my first goal in terms of support for teachers, especially I think the female teachers and the few teachers of color we have, I don't even think we have that many, but
yeah, we have like one Chinese substitute.
There's such a minimal amount of diversity among staff in this town that my vision was to work towards getting money to help train our staff and our administrators on how to be a vision of tolerance, or, you know, to have an ability to see things from a different perspective. Tolerance for me is such like a, ooh, it just like puts chills down my back. It's like, we shouldn't have to be tolerated. But what we need to have is acceptance, you know, and unconditional support and understanding. And I think there's always conditions to where you get to be. There was a condition for me. There's always conditions, and those conditions aren't made known to me. I have to figure out what those conditions are. And that's the struggle with being a person of color in America, is there's all these rules and they're unspoken rules. You have to figure out what's going to make you a quote match.
I don't know if you ever got any pressure from parents because of what you did in, you know, in schools or whatever. I mean, were there any complaints from parents or teachers from what you were doing?
No, not. I mean, I think I was warned, you know, it's about that match for the district thing. And I was warned going into Bechtel Grove that I needed to do my job as a resource teacher, as though I hadn't really done my job as a resource teacher at the high school. And, you know, I take it with a grain of salt because I can't say that's exactly what the person meant when they said it to me. But the fact that they felt the need to say it to me after I've been teaching special education for 7 years tells me that there's some uncomfortableness with the format of how I design my resource class. And I have to tell you, even in doing those journals about life, purpose, love, hope, faith, all of those words that really give a student a sense of morality, you know, and we wrote about life after the incident at the country store and the murder with the homeless man in town. And those kids really took to heart that process. And they really came forth with what was real to them. And that is what I respect in the learning process. That it's not always about what's in the text, but it's about getting kids where they're at and then taking them to a different level. And that's where our teachers need to learn how to teach to that degree. Because a lot of teachers rely solely on their textbooks. And they don't know how to go outside of the text. And if you can't go outside of the text, you really shouldn't be a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Because teaching has to do with not only connecting students to text, but connecting them to society. You know, if they can't identify with what's happening in the world, if they can't tell you about, you know, what's going on in the Middle East, you know, they're not in tune with and in touch with what's happening here. And that's where teachers got to take our kids. And that's where I took my students. Every student that came into my room left with an understanding of the fact that this world has a lot to work through. And each one of them can make a difference, just like every person in this world can make a difference. And that's always my theme. And we're going to do the same thing in Bechtel Grove. So get ready. Confederate flag stuff was not allowed in my classroom ever. You know, if you wanted to wear it, you need to find somewhere else to go. And it was big for a lot of my students. They didn't understand, you know, why they didn't have the freedom of speech to wear that flag.
You know, the Confederate flag, I see it everywhere at the high school, not only in the high school, in town. You know, I don't understand why people would want to be so proud to wear it on their clothing or to write it in textbooks or whatnot. You know, I mean, you see it everywhere. And It's a symbol of hatred and racism and slavery. And if they do fully understand it, then I would like to go up to them and ask them about it. But I don't think if I did, they would be able to tell me what it meant. And so I think being a person of color, it's really offensive to see that. It's almost like seeing a neo-Nazi sign being worn on someone's clothing. And if I saw that, I don't know what I would do. But you're not allowed to do that. But you would think they would because it's freedom of speech. Yeah. They can wear, you know, if they can wear Confederate flags, then I should be able to wear whatever I want to school.
At our last faculty meeting we had at Willits High School, the discussion was about dress code and what students should or should not be allowed to wear to school. And the main focal point of the dress code dilemma was what females were wearing because they were being too revealing with their breasts, with their short skirts. And not once did the topic of the Confederate flag come up in the dress code conversation. And for me, at the time, being on my way out of the high school, it was just one battle that I didn't feel like getting into at the time. But I think for the students, if you're going to start addressing girls or young women for having a shirt that shows too much cleavage, and telling them they can't wear that or they need to cover that up, then you need to start doing the same for the people who come to school with Confederate flags that are a symbol of racism or white pride or whatever you want to call the symbol to be a representation of, because both are just as disturbing, you know. And for me personally, I'd almost rather see a girl with her body showing than the Confederate flag. I mean, if you really want to get down to it, and yet why would that be the most disturbing thing? Well, then you have to look at the makeup of the staff. When you have all males and they're primarily white males, you know, the Confederate flag isn't a big deal to them. But seeing a girl that's very revealing is disturbing. Yes. And it's disturbing for you because it touches you in a different way. Well, try walking in my shoes for a day and seeing 40, 50 Confederate flags throughout the hallways, in books, on posters. You know, I had one teacher say, well, we're reading a story about the South and, you know, the students were allowed to do a drawing of whatever they wanted. And there was, you know, all across the wall, plastered Confederate flags. And I said, well, was that the message of the story? Because otherwise, why would you have that as the symbol? I'm like, couldn't they have made a map of Mississippi?
That's all my questions. I think we covered a lot of ground. Do you have anything else to say, add in?
Just want to put that one probe in there for November 1st. Lee Moonwa is going to be here 11:30 till 3. And he's the director of two current movies that are out, The Color of Fear and Walking Each Other Home. And he has a third movie coming out. They're all documentaries. They're not movies. But they're all dialogues between primarily men, particularly all men of color, with maybe one or two men of European descent who have typically not experienced any kind of interactions with people of color. They've been really secluded, living in their suburbia world, you know, gated communities where there's nothing coming in but people like themselves. And they have discussions and dialogues about what it means to be where they're at in America. And the dialogues and the discussions are so powerful and so deep. It's just deep. Like when you start hearing these stories and then you start hearing people, especially the two men, try to convince the men of color that are in the group that they're overreacting, that it's really not that bad. Lee Moonwa is very much about having dialogues. He wants to have the conversations. He wants the conversations to come out, to emerge. He wants to hear people try to justify why it's okay to arrest a black man just because he looks suspicious. He wants that kind of stuff to come out. And I think we need, as a town, we need to hear it. And as a police force, they definitely need to hear it, because even my cousins that lived here have been harassed. You know, every 2 to 3 weeks when they were here, they'd get arrested are, you know, pulled over or questioned because they look like someone that, you know, had done something in Santa Rosa or Cloverdale or wherever, you know, and, you know, it's bogus. It's really some bull. So I think we're ready. Come hear Lee Moonwah and then, you know, sign up for other dialogues. We're going to recruit people to go hear more dialogues. That's where the rest of our training money is going to go to, our diversity dialogue trainings. We're taking students. We're taking community members. We're taking firefighters, policemen, nurses, librarians, anyone who wants to come, janitors. Final thing I want to put out there to the community is that we currently have a $23,000 tolerance education grant given to us by Community Prevention in Action and the California State Department of Education. And I really want community members to call in as many as you can and tell us some ideas you have for spending this $23,000 to help improve the level of education and awareness in our community. And also, feel free to even come by to the library on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 6:30. We have discussions on better ways to promote awareness in our town using this money as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Janetta Mwadwakalim, for coming and speaking and giving us, you know, your thoughts and letting us hear what you feel and think. And it was really fun. I'm glad to hear it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Say, say, say.
That music was by Tracy Chapman. That was an interview from You Speaks Out in August of 2001. Ida Levinson was interviewing Janetta McLaughlin about her experiences being the first African-American teacher to try to work at Willits High School. The entire 60-minute show is available in streaming audio at our website, www.youthspeaksout.net. In 2000, I was able to arrange an interview between Willits High School student Alicia and Michael Franti of the hip-hop group Spearhead. This was recorded in the mountains outside of Willits. We were creating a series of programs on youth and substances on a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
My name's Alicia, and I'm here with
Michael Franti from Spearhead.
We're going to talk about media and how it's influencing teens to do drugs and alcohol. So what are your opinions on teens doing drugs?
Well, drugs are a very complicated issue for all people, but especially for young people in this culture, because this is a culture that defines certain things as drugs and other things not as drugs. And those things that are defined as drugs are things that are really bad that you can go to jail for and that will supposedly ruin your life. And other things that they don't define as drugs, people do to excess and end up killing themselves anyway. And so I think any conversation that you have about drugs, it's really important to define first what it is that you're talking about. I don't really have a real succinct explanation for what drugs are, but I do know that the prescription drugs and alcohol and tobacco are very much as dangerous as the quote-unquote illegal drugs that we have in this country. And it's important for young people to understand that. Every time you turn on the TV set or listen to a radio station, you're going to hear messages about, you know, here's this beer that you should drink and it's going to make you do all these things and make you be really cool with the girls, and there's all these funny and clever commercials, and it's put right there in between the football game and the basketball game. And same thing with tobacco, you know, there's all these commercials now today that are the tobacco industry saying R.J. Reynolds really cares about people and we give all this money every year to these things to do good things for people. And meanwhile, in this country, over 400,000 people die a year of lung cancer from tobacco. And I don't know how many people die of alcohol, but I know that in my own life as a teenager, it was something that really affected me because my father was an alcoholic. And when I was 17, I ran away from home because of that. Later, my father went on to stop drinking, because when I eventually came back, I told him that I wasn't going to live in a house with him. And I asked him if he had a drinking problem, and he said, yeah, I've been an alcoholic for 9 years, and I don't care if it kills me. And I said, well, I care. I really care if it kills you, and I'm not going to sit back and watch you do this. And so he quit drinking, but I moved out of the house very soon after that, so I didn't really get to be around him much when he wasn't drunk. You know, later in life, last year he had a stroke, and during his recovery from his stroke, he became a completely different person, a very much changed person. And one of the things he said to me is, he said, "Thank you for being the person who stood up to me and said, you know, that it's time to stop." The prescription drugs and the quote-unquote legal drugs are as dangerous as the illegal drug. I think the same thing goes with pot. I think there's not enough discussion that takes place with young people and with their parents and family about pot. And so what happens is a lot of kids end up doing the wake and bake routine, which at a young age can be really stifling to people's progression. It's important to understand that you know, pot has medicinal purposes and it has ability to expand your mind and create a new openness in you creatively. But it's just like anything else. If you wake up on Saturday morning and eat 12 Snickers bars and watch cartoons, you're not going to be a very aware person, you know. But if you use it in moderation, what it's about, and learn its effects and learn when it's okay to use it and when it's not okay to use it, just like beer or just like, you know, an occasional glass of wine, it can be a part of your life. And I think that the laws that we have in this country, like the whole thing of being 21 before you drink, ends up making young people turn to alcohol in a very aggressive way. As soon as they turn 21, they think the first thing they need to do is go and get slobbery drunk and fall down in a bar. In my family and my household, I have a son who's 13 years old, and he's always been told that if you want to drink, you can drink with us and the family. And so far, he's had a few sips of wine. He's never been one to really like want to drink. But I want to teach him about what it means to drink responsibly. And if he wants to have a glass of wine, or if he wants to occasionally have a hit of pot or whatever it is, he's going to know what it's about, and he's going to know how to do it, and not just be turned, set free into the world and say, "Hey, go and, you know, find out about drugs and alcohol from TV." Another thing is that there's a lot of pressure from the media to be consumers. And I think that the danger of consumerism is just as dangerous as drugs and alcohol. There's these notions that, you know, if you buy a certain pair of shoes, and if you buy certain clothes, or if you can afford a certain type of car, that it's going to make you a certain type of person. That materialism and that addiction to buying things can be just as dangerous as drugs and alcohol, because it shuts off our spirit. It turns our spirit into being like a mannequin, where we're just dressed up in all these things, and what's really going on inside us doesn't matter anymore. And when we develop that type of consciousness, it leaves us wide open to I don't want to call it a demon, because I don't view it as that, but that part of us that becomes addictive to drugs and alcohol is the part that says, you know, I'm afraid to be who I am, and I don't want to deal with the feelings I'm feeling, so I'm going to medicate it. And some of us medicate it with drugs and alcohol, and some of us medicate it with consumerism, and some medicate it with sex or whatever, but it's all about trying to forget about who you are and what your pains and worries are. And so I think that consumerism and just purchasing things all the time is something that we really need to look out for.
Okay, earlier when you were talking about alcohol, mm-hmm. I see that just as bad as doing drugs, mm-hmm. if not worse. Mm-hmm. And do you notice, like, I'll just call it substance use, because whether it's alcohol, drugs, anything, do you notice this when you're performing?
Yeah, I perform in a lot of clubs and bars, and I notice it a lot when people are drunk. Sometimes, I notice the difference between other drugs. I notice that when people are smoking pot at my concerts, they're generally peaceful and want to have fun. When people are drinking, they end up getting in fights and become aggressive. And unfortunately, the way that nightclubs work in this country is that you have to be 21 to get in because that's where they make their money. They don't really make their money off selling tickets with the band. They make their money off of the alcohol that they sell when 500 people show up at the club. And so it prevents young people from getting into the concerts, and it puts a lot of pressure on people to drink because they're constantly pushing that at us. And we try as much as we can as a band, a spearhead, to play in all ages places and to play at places where alcohol is not the main focus of what's going on.
Does people that are drunk or high or on ecstasy or acid, for instance, mm-hmm. does this affect your performance in any way?
Well, it doesn't affect my performance in that it doesn't make me feel like, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to perform with 100% of my heart tonight because people are drunk or whatever. But what it does make me do at times is I'll address it. You know, if I see people who are really drunk, I'll talk about it from the stage. You know, or if I see people who are on a lot of ecstasy and stuff, I'll talk to people about, you know, about being safe and not combining drugs, because that's one of the things that happens is people start combining ecstasy with alcohol and pot and other things, and that's when they end up really getting sick or really getting hurt. You know, I've been to Holland, because, you know, people always say, well, America, love it or leave it, because it's the best system in the world, and I've been to Holland, and I've been to concert department right there at the front door of the concert, but the police department is not there to bust people. The police department is there to test your ecstasy and make sure that your ecstasy is clean and isn't really, you know, polluted with a lot of stuff. And they'll say, hey, here, we tested your stuff and it has this much of this stuff and this much, and we would advise that you only take this amount or whatever. And so the police department and the health department in Holland work very closely together in making sure that young people are doing safe practices, and pot is legal there, and young people grow up learning how to use it and grow up learning how to use alcohol in ways that are safe and sane, rather than in this country where people are just have to do it behind closed doors or whatever and end up killing themselves. And another big element to that is the criminal justice system, where in this country, 70% of the 2 million people who are behind bars for drug-related offenses and are serving mandatory minimum sentences, which are sentences where a judge has no discretion in terms of how long you're supposed to be locked up. There's just a mandatory minimum that says if you did a certain thing, you have 5 years minimum. And it's really crippling our country, and it's really crippling our generation of young people. And the reason that it's continued to go on is that prisons are a big business. If you imagine having a prison that holds about 2,000 people and you have to feed them breakfast, lunch, and dinner and put clothes on them and provide certain services for them. If you had a restaurant that served 2,000 meals at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, that would be a very big money-making restaurant. And so there's the prison industry is one that makes a lot of money for communities, and it costs between $29,000 and $40,000 a year to house one prisoner. And I think that there are certain people who are addicts and who have a health issue, which is that they're addicted to, you know, certain drugs, cocaine and heroin, cigarettes and alcohol especially, that should be treated as patients within a healthcare system. People who are selling drugs and especially hard drugs, for the most part, do it because they haven't had other opportunities in their life. And they see, like, hey, should I go and work at McDonald's for $5 an hour, or should I go out on the street and slang dope? You know, they choose that option, and they end up getting locked up. I live in Hunters Point, San Francisco, which is an all-black neighborhood, and we have 24-hour police surveillance coming through our communities and busting young people for selling pot and for selling crack on the streets. What ends up happening is those youth go into jail, and they spend 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years in there, and by the time they come out, they're people that I don't even want to hang out with. you know, because they've been so brutalized and had so much sensory deprivation and been so confined with violence, you know, that they come out and they're not nice people anymore. Not that they can't be saved or brought back to being, to finding that place of goodness in their heart, but they've been in these conditions. And so it destroys our community in that way. It destroys our community in that a lot of really bad drugs are brought into our community. And it destroys our community in that they're spending money on prisons rather than on education, which is a way to expand people's minds and give them opportunities to do something productive.
Teenagers, I can't say that all teenagers are going to experiment, but there are a proportion of teenagers that would and will. Do you think that they should just wait until they're older? And well, just, you know, because we're still developing and...
I think that, you know, I'm not a doctor, but I know that physiologically, you know, it's important for your body to develop before you, you know, lift a lot of weights or something, because it hurts the cartilage in your bones and it could stunt your growth. And, you know, I think that it's important that young people lead as healthy, clean childhoods as they possibly can. And I know that there's a lot of pressure out there to experiment with drugs. And I think that the only thing I can suggest to people is, yeah, it's good to wait for as long as you can. But the reality is there's so much pressure. And the best thing is to find out as much information as you can about whatever it is that you're using. There's nothing wrong with abstinence, and there's nothing wrong with saying no. And if you feel like uncomfortable about doing anything, just sit, tell your friends or whoever's putting the pressure on you, you know, this is not for me. I'm not ready for this, and I don't want to do this yet. And there's really nothing wrong with that. The other thing I would suggest is that, you know, there's so much pressure that's placed on kids to just say no and all this stuff. And I think that it's really important that we find things that we can say yes to, you know. Music is one of those things, and, you know, outdoor activities and spending time in nature and spending time communing with friends is a really great thing that really fills me up. And I remember when I was a kid, that was my favorite thing, was to spend time with my friends and just to hang out. And I think that it's important for young people to become involved politically, become involved civically in our communities, and put pressure on the adults. Because we're 25% of the population, but we don't get 25% of the money from taxes being spent. And you have these things like Proposition 21 that are the juvenile justice bill that is, they're trying to lock up young people for doing these petty crimes and try and treat them as adults, but we don't get to vote. They say that you're supposed to be allowed to be tried by a jury of your peers, but we're not tried by other teens, and that's not who the jury's made up of. It's made up of adults. And it's really important for us to become aware of what's going on with young people in our schools and fight for after-school programs and fight for community centers and really raise our voices and stand up and organize, because that's how things get done. And every time it's a teacher or somebody tells you, you know, you shouldn't do drugs, you should look them back in the eye and say to them, well, then if we agree not to do drugs, then are you going to agree to build us a community center or to have a dance for us on every Friday night or do something for us so that we can have other opportunities to say yes to things rather than you always telling us to say no to things? And for any adults that's listening too, that onus is on you all too, is to really, if you have the best interest of youth in mind, don't just keep telling them no to things. Be providing them opportunities to do stuff.
Earlier you said that we need to have more things we can say yes to, and you listed music as one of those things. I fully agree with that. Point I'd like to bring up is, do you think that music in any way promotes or influences the drug use?
Yeah, I do. I mean, there's songs about drugs, and there's often times the sort of negative aspects of drug culture are glorified in music. But I think that music is about an expression of emotions. And the reason that young people are attracted to songs about about getting drunk or about getting high or about, you know, violence or stuff like that. It's because it's emotions that we're feeling in our hearts. And sometimes music is our only way to give voice to them. We hear songs about something and it pulls out emotions that are in us. The thing I have to say to that is that, you know, it's really important that we understand that MTV and the radio and all these things that are promoting those types of music are there because, not because they care about you, but because they want to suck every last dollar out of your wallet. And their sole motivation is to remove you from your money. And so they are there to try to promote the stuff that they think is going to get kids to give up that money. And they're going to put these messages out there that are all about you go out and shoot each other and kill each other and take all kinds of drugs and fall down and hurt yourself and do destructive things to yourself because they know that it's going to get them paid. You know, and that's a really sad and unfortunate thing. And I think that it's really good when young people can listen to music and seek out underground music and other types of music that aren't just what the corporation is telling you to do and telling you to buy. You know, I remember when I was a kid that there was a lot of underground music that I only heard when I was listening to college radio stations. And so I eventually turned to that other side of the dial and stopped listening to the commercial and corporate music, and I found that there was really cool music that was really about loving life and was about positivity and was about us finding the best in ourselves and wasn't just about self-destruction. There's still that music that's out there, and you know, you have to go and look for it. And if you can't go and look for it and find it, then you have to pick up an instrument or get on a mic and start rhyming or get some turntables and start DJing and do it yourself, you know. And that's what I really dug. When I was a kid, there was hip-hop and there was punk rock that was just starting out. And the thing that was great about hip-hop was that anybody could just go and get some turntables and start rapping over a beat, or could sit on the corner and start beatboxing and start rhyming. And there wasn't all this pressure for it to be about how much money we could make or how much records we could sell or how much gold chains we could get. It was just all about creativity and about expressing ourselves. And the same thing in punk rock existed. There was this thing called DIY, which is do it yourself, and don't you know, feel like because you can't play a guitar very well that you can't get up on stage and sing songs just knowing two chords, you know, or whatever. And I dig that spirit and I admire that spirit in youth today. And I see it when I see kids getting on a skateboard and doing, you know, double flips off the top of a ramp, or when they're snowboarding, or when they're surfing, or whatever. You know, there's that spirit that we have, that we can achieve things if we really practice and set our minds to it. And you know, don't listen to adults saying this is something that you're just wasting your time doing. I believe that anything that you work on, that you work on hard and discipline that and try to perfect, is only going to help you in life. And it's not that you're going to become a world-class skateboarder and do that until you're 60 years old, but that discipline that you learn in practicing those skateboard tricks is going to be discipline that helps you to become a great artist, or to become a great civic leader, or to become a great parent, or just become a great person that really loves and cares about other people. So whatever it is that you find, if you, you know, because there's a lot of people who don't find that they do well in school, and I was one of those people that didn't do well in school, and I just really didn't feel like I fit in, and I had problems when I was a kid. But I really loved to play basketball when I was a kid, and I really loved to write poetry when I was a kid, and I really liked to make music, and so I really concentrated just on those things that I liked, you know. And I figured, hey, maybe I can't do really great in math, but I'm going to try really hard at the things that I do really enjoy and I do really like, and I'm going to really make the best of them. And that's really helped me today. You know, now that I'm a parent and now that I'm a musician professionally, and that discipline that I learned as a kid really helped. So, you know, if you draw or whatever it is, or you make music or like to play sports or snowboard or ski or whatever, just do it to the best that you can. Find one thing in your life that you like and that you're good at, and really work on perfecting it.
How long have you been a professional musician?
Well, I made my first record in 1987. We had this group called the Beatniks, and we just recorded our own music, and we put out a record, and we got in a van, and we just drove from town to town, and we would just play, and we would just, at the end of the night, we'd ask people for donations, and sometimes you'd get 25 or 50 bucks, and that would give us gas money to get to the next place, you know, and we would ask people just, you know, do you have a place to stay, and can you put us up, and can you help feed us, or whatever, and we did that for a couple of years, you know, just like that, and we loved it, and it was a really great education for me, because I had never really traveled a lot, and just to see different parts of the country, and we went to Europe eventually, and was really like kind of like my college education, you know. You know, I would talk to kids who go to college, and I'd say, hey, well, what books are you reading? And they wouldn't have read any books, you know, except their class books, the textbooks, you know. And I was reading books, and I was traveling, and I was seeing the world, and I was writing things, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I believe that there's so much pressure in the society that if you don't go to college, that you're going to be a waste of a person. And a lot of people start believing that. And it's totally not the case. You know, I think there's three or even four types of education. The first one is your home training, you know, like just right and wrong. Don't hit your brother. Don't throw sand at the other kid's eyes, you know. And just basic right and wrong. That's your home training. And then there's the school training. You know, you go to school and you learn to read and write, and you learn about, you know, history and mathematics and science and stuff. But then there's the education of the street, you know, and there's the education of just the world, of learning how to get along with other people, you know, and learning how to confront situations and deal with situations and stay out of harm's way, and to be able to stick up for yourself and to find out what it is that you like. And I think then there's a fourth level of education, which is a spiritual education. You know, it's an understanding of who you are as a person, understanding what's in your heart and in your mind. And none of those forms of education are any more or less important than any of them. Some people excel in some areas and don't do as well in other areas, but we have our whole life to do all of those things, and don't feel the pressure that if you don't make it into college, or that if you don't feel comfortable being in school now, that you can't still learn and educate yourself in other ways. And maybe some point in your life you'll go back to that college, you'll go back to that, you know, formal type of classroom education. But it's not the end of the world if you don't excel. But you have to try to excel in those other areas if you can't excel in school.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
So much.
All right.
It was great talking to you.
Thank you.
Sometimes I feel like a sociogenetic experiment, a petri dish community's token of infection. I feel like a sociogenetic experiment, a petri dish community's token of infection. You see, I'm African, Native American, Irish and German. I was adopted by parents who loved me. They were the same color as the kids who called me nigger on the walk home from school. I cried until I found out what it meant. Then I got me some equipment, my fist man. I was a hit man with no friends. But who the hell am I cursing those whose skin is half my DNA? Why am I and why shouldn't I be ashamed of this fact? After all the feces they dumped on me and my species. But sometimes I feel like a sociogenetic experiment, a petri dish community's token of infection. I feel like a sociogenetic experiment, a petri dish community's token of infection. Those filthy mothers, shut your mouth. There I go again with those high and mighty speeches, when they are in fact part of my species. Or is it the other way around? Did I piss in their gene pool? If I did, it wouldn't matter. They kept me in the deep end.
Cause the slightest dilution in their solution was perceived as pollution. But sometimes I feel like a sociogenetic experiment, a petri dish community's token of infection. I feel like a sociogenetic experiment, a petri dish community's token of infection. Destiny. I am the human scientific process over and over and over again. The dirt that I shovel to uncover the truth often buries something else growing. Acceptance of my own weakness and my own intolerance is seldom. But that is in fact my identity, uncluttered by the maskings of consumer addiction. Ethnocentricity in the light of miscegenation. This fable of elements which classify order, species, subspecies, genus, phyla, animal, vegetable, illegal, chemical, socialist, democrat, republican, yuppie, buppy, guppy, proud, racist, black, white, African, Native American, Irish, and German. Sometimes I feel like a sociogenetic experiment, a petri dish community's token of infection. I feel like a sociogenetic experiment, a petri dish community's token of infection. I feel like a sociogenetic experiment, a petri dish community's token of infection. I feel like a sociogenetic experiment, a petri dish community's token of infection. A petri dish community's token of infection. A petri dish community's. And I'm proud.
That was an interview by Alicia from Willits High School with Michael Franti of Spearhead. It was recorded in 2000 and is available to listen to in streaming audio at our website, www.youthspeaksout.net. The music following the interview was by Michael's earlier group, The Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy. Youth Speaks Out is produced in cooperation with HALT, Healthy Activities for Laytonville Teens. HALT is a project designed by Laytonville's Healthy Start program. The project is creating many alternative activities for teens in our community. For more information, please contact Healthy Start at 984-8089 or visit their website at www.laytonville.org/healthystart.html. Youth Speaks Out is produced and directed by Dan Roberts, who may be reached by mail at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, or through the website youthspeaksout.net. There you can find out more information about the project, get addresses for contacting us, get a copy of a show, or listen to many hours of previous programming in streaming audio. That's youthspeaksout.net. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KZYX. They are the views of those who express them. Our next show will be the last Sunday of March. That's the 31st at 2 p.m. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next month.